Over the last several years, a number of important clinical trials have evaluated the use of androgen deprivation and radiation therapy in men with high-risk localized prostate cancer. I met with Dr. Anthony D'Amico to get his take on where we are and where we're headed with this treatment strategy, and he began our conversation by commenting on new trials evaluating chemotherapy in these patients and continuing new data sets refining the use of endocrine therapy.
With regard to the management of the high-risk patients, there are several ongoing clinical trials now that are looking at the role of Taxotere in addition to standard therapies. So there is randomized trials now looking at Taxotere in addition to radiation and hormonal therapy, and Taxotere in addition to surgery and hormonal therapy. There's no answers yet, but those are underway. These trials have accrued now in the order of several hundred patients and will probably close in the 2008 to 2009 timeframe, and some answers will follow. So that's one piece. The other piece in the management of high-risk cancer, which is a story that's evolving, there are issues that have been raised about hormonal therapy, not so much from a cancer control standpoint, but more from a quality of life and comorbid side effects standpoint, whereby men now who are older than 65 in general, are predisposed to metabolic abnormalities as a result of the use of hormonal therapy. There's a publication this past year in Journal of Clinical Oncology by the group out of MGH, which shows from using the SEER Medicare database that men getting hormonal therapy are more likely to develop diabetes and more likely to be admitted to the hospital for myocardial infarction or at least chest pain. And there are going to be two abstracts presented in a couple of weeks in the meeting in Florida, the Prostate Cancer ASCO meeting, and these have now been published in abstract form so I can comment on them, that both show, both from a retrospective look in the CAPTCHA database and from a prospective look in a meta-analysis of three randomized studies, that the occurrence of fatal MIs is significantly increased in men over the age of 65 with as little as 3 months of hormonal therapy. And so, given that, and given the fact that we know that hormonal therapy does increase curability of prostate cancer in men undergoing radiation for high-risk disease, I think that we're going to have to be a little bit more intelligent about how we use hormonal therapy and what we think about doing and how we counsel men prior to the start of hormonal therapy. Specifically, if they are men who have known vascular disease or men with diabetes, consideration to perhaps a cardiovascular consult or a stress test before the hormonal therapy is initiated may be worthwhile, because there's a lot of evidence now suggesting that these fatal MIs that occur really occur within the first 2 years. So they occur relatively shortly after you start the hormonal therapy. It's not a late effect. It's really a subacute effect. And then there's one more piece to this puzzle, which is also data that will be presented in a couple of weeks in the Florida meeting, and that's, to summarize it briefly, it's not the duration of hormonal therapy administered that appears to provide the cancer-specific survival benefit, but rather the duration of testosterone suppression that is achieved in an individual patient as a result of a fixed course of hormonal therapy administration. So to say it concretely, if you give someone 6 months of hormonal therapy and they're 70 years old, that therapy will suppress that man's testosterone on average for another 18 months or 2 years of testosterone suppression. Whereas if that man was 50, the testosterone rebounds within 2 to 3 months after the end of the 6 months of hormonal therapy. And so we really may be over-treating older men with hormonal therapy and perhaps under-treating younger men. And since the morbidity I just described to you about the cardiovascular issues really is in older men, there may be a way here to improve our therapeutic ratio by tailoring hormonal therapy in men with high-risk disease who are older based on their testosterone levels after the administration of the hormonal therapy, and not just saying I'm going to give you 2 years or 3 years or 6 months, but rather I'm going to give you 2 years of testosterone suppression, whatever that takes in terms of hormonal therapy administration.
Let's talk about the first thing that you mentioned, which is this issue of cardiovascular morbidity. What are the presumed mechanisms by which that would occur?
We can speculate, but there's no concrete information yet on what the truth is. The speculation is that hormonal therapy induces in an elderly gentleman something called metabolic syndrome. And metabolic syndrome is characterized predominantly by an increase in the body mass index, so essentially an increased circumference around the waist. And other things that contribute to the diagnosis of metabolic syndrome is high cholesterol levels and or hypertension. So what happens when you give a gentleman hormonal therapy is they do increase their body mass index, they do get less favorable cholesterol profiles, and in a sense, most of them meet the criteria for metabolic syndrome, which has been associated with subsequent cardiovascular events. That's been known for a long time in the cardiac literature. Now, how that actually transpires, how increasing a man's weight, making their cholesterol less favorable, actually leads to a fatal myocardial infarction is up for speculation, but the current thinking is this. We know that in the intima, the inner lining of the coronary arteries, the endothelial cells have testosterone receptors in men. And when you deprive a man of testosterone, it's been shown that those cells inflame and create an inflammatory reaction, which is the first phase, if you will, or the setup for plaque formation. So this is a theory. It's not been shown. Proof of principle still remains. But people think that perhaps by taking a man who's already got some coronary artery disease, i.e. an older gentleman, depriving them of testosterone, setting up this inflammatory reaction in the coronary arteries may be enough to tip them over the edge. So if they're 80% occluded already and they don't know it, this additional inflammation may add enough to it that when the blood comes through, it may form a clot because of that local inflammatory reaction around the plaque and create an MI. Now, this is speculative, Neil, just so you know, but that's some of the current thinking.
Any way to quantify in a 70-year-old, otherwise healthy person or in any kind of situation what this risk might be?
In the data that we've looked at, three randomized trials where the men's median age went from 67 to 72, the absolute increase percentage-wise at 2 years in fatal myocardial infarctions in men over the age of 65 was 4%. The relative risk, if you will, or I should say the hazard ratio, was approximately 1.3. So in mathematical terms, it's a 30% increase in risk, which translates into a 4% absolute increase in the rate of fatal MIs at 2 years in men over the age of 65 getting short courses of hormonal therapy in conjunction with radiation for high-risk prostate cancer.
So it sounds like if you can identify the men who really need this for their prostate cancer, who are really threatened by this, that maybe this actually won't, in that situation, be that much of an issue quantitatively.
Right. That's the whole idea of the therapeutic ratio, which is how bad is the cancer and how much does it need treatment? Is this a Gleason 8 with a PSA of 25? Or is this a Gleason 4 plus 3 in a single core, 5% of the core and a PSA of 4.1? And then you have to look at the underlying health of the gentleman. Is this a man who's 68 and never had a medical issue in his life? Or is this a man who's 68 who's already had an MI, is being medically managed with stable angina and has a history of diabetes? So those two things have to be weighed. And if we take a specific example, let's take a 68-year-old gentleman who's healthy, no medical history of coronary artery disease or hypertension or diabetes, and has the PSA of 25 and the Gleason 8. Clearly, this is the gentleman who needs the hormonal therapy because the prostate cancer is far more likely to take his life without best treatment compared to cardiovascular issues. But if that same 68-year-old gentleman, you know, had an MI 5 years ago, is being medically managed and also has a history of diabetes and has a PSA of 4.1, a Gleason 4 plus 3 in a single core, one could argue in that case whether or not hormonal therapy should be administered at all. Maybe this is a gentleman who just had high-dose radiation. You could also argue in that case maybe you should have a workup, a stress test, before one would consider hormonal therapy.
You were also talking about this issue of duration of hormonal therapy. What do we know about the relationship with duration and this potential cardiovascular impact?
So the papers that have been published so far, or at least written in abstract form, suggest that you don't need much. As little as 3 months appears to confer the risk.
But I mean, for example, is 3 years a lot worse than 3 months?
Not clear. The papers that have been written don't find a difference when you look at duration, which to me is quite fascinating. It means that the risk is imparted early.
So maybe it's kind of like a stress test.
Perhaps. I mean, within the first few months of hormonal therapy, you start to see the weight gain and the fatigue and all the things that we know can induce in a gentleman who's predisposed a cardiac event.
Now, you also talked about this issue of the duration of true androgen suppression as opposed to treatment. Can you talk more about the practical way you approach this to try to manage patients?
Well, let's first be clear that this is now an association that has been, if you will, observed. If we just go back to the data that was published prior to 2005, we have known for a long time that a man's age and where he's at in, quote, andropause will dictate how long a fixed course of hormonal therapy will last in him or will suppress his testosterone. So there's a paper written by the SWOG group looking at a series of men, about 85, who had 6 months of hormonal therapy, and they asked the question, how long did the testosterone stay suppressed below the lower limit of normal for that given assay in men who got 6 months of hormonal therapy and then stopped, given age? And they found that as the men aged, it would stay suppressed longer. And the kind of numbers you're looking at is if a man is 70 and gets 6 months of hormonal therapy, on average, his testosterone will stay below his baseline for about another 18 months. So now, having said that, there is a single study that will be presented in a couple of weeks in the Florida meeting that took it a step further and said, okay, if I know how long a man's testosterone stays suppressed for after the 6 months of hormonal therapy, is there any relationship between that duration of testosterone suppression and the time to cancer-specific death following radiation and 6 months of hormonal therapy? And the answer is actually yes, there is. It turns out that the longer a man's testosterone stays suppressed after giving just 6 months of hormonal therapy, the more likely they are to survive and not die of prostate cancer.
Could you sort of drill into the data that led to that conclusion you just made?
So there were 220 men who received radiation and 6 months of hormonal therapy for high-risk prostate cancer. They all had testosterone levels, same assay, at baseline.
Is this your six-month study?
The six-month study we did had 102 men who got radiation and 6 months of hormones. So this is those 102 plus another 118 who were treated during the same time period. So they all had baseline testosterone, and they had testosterone levels gathered every 3 months for 2 years, every 6 months out to 5 years, and every year thereafter. And what one did was, is they said, okay, the man's baseline testosterone is 350. Let's give him the 6 months of hormonal therapy, measure his testosterone, look when it comes back to 350, and then measure how long that took. That interval, if it took 18 months, 12 months, 6 months, correlates or is associated with the length of subsequent survival from their prostate cancer.
That's amazing. Have you presented that?
2 weeks, we'll present it.
Wow, incredible.
I think that it's quite interesting because what it says in a nutshell is it's not how much hormonal therapy you give, but how long it lasts in a given man that matters.
But there is a correlation, though, between the duration of effectively androgen suppression and the prostate cancer impact. That's amazing.
That's right. Well, it's not surprising.
No, it's not. But has that been demonstrated before?
No, it hasn't. It's a new finding.
Wow.
And I think it will be one of the important messages in 2007. The reason why is because right now we're unclear as to whether all men with Gleason 8, 9, or 10 prostate cancer require long-term hormonal therapy to affect the benefit that they have been shown to have in studies where long-term is the standard of care. Right now, 2 or 3 years of hormonal therapy is a standard of care for men with Gleason 8 to 10 prostate cancer. And the question now becomes, is it 2 or 3 years of giving hormonal therapy, or is it 2 or 3 years of testosterone suppression, which in some men will be 2 years of hormonal therapy, and in other men, maybe only 6 months?
Or is it 5 years?
Well, that's another question. So it could all be up in the air. But what's clear now is that what really matters here is effective length of testosterone suppression and not effective length of hormonal therapy administration.
Now, this study of the men who got treated for 6 months, what is the longest that the androgen suppression continued? Are there men who are out 4 or 5 years now?
So the median follow-up in this study is about 7 years, and 9% of these men never return to a normal testosterone level. They remain castrate for good just after 6 months of hormonal therapy.
And do those do the best?
Absolutely.
Wow. You know, because it took 15, maybe 20 years to work this out in breast cancer. You know, first they started out doing 1 year of tamoxifen, then they showed 2 was better than 1. Eventually they showed 5 was better than 2. They thought greater than 5 wasn't better. Now they're not sure. I mean, is there some way that we can kind of make some clinical decisions?
I think that Whenever you have an initial observation, others will want to confirm and validate it. And then from there, we think of what to do. So you asked, you know, what the clinical implication would be, and this would be the way I would look at it. If, in fact, let's say 2 years of testosterone suppression is the ideal we're looking for in men with high-risk disease, one could give a gentleman 6 months of hormonal therapy, monitor their testosterone level, so withdraw it at the end of 6 months, and as soon as the testosterone level starts to rebound and gets within, you know, a certain number of the lower limit of normal, add another 1 month or 3 month depot in order to achieve 2 years of testosterone suppression and not necessarily 2 years of hormonal therapy administration. Now, the way one would have to prove that that's equal to long-term hormonal therapy would be in the setting of a trial where one arm would be what I just told you and the other arm would just be 2 years of continuous hormonal therapy. And what you would do at the end is you would look to see if there was any difference in time to progression and death. You'd have to provide yourself in the beginning with some assurance that 2 years is the right number. Because you said before, is it three? Is it five? What is it? Such a trial could be done, and that would be the proof of principle that would be needed to show equivalence.
So I guess an obvious question also as we track back through these two issues in terms of the cardiovascular thing and the prostate cancer control thing is where would bicalutamide monotherapy theoretically fit in?
With regard to monotherapies, none of these studies that I mentioned really looked at that question, although it's a great question. We know that there was some concern in the bicalutamide trial in the guys who got randomized to bicalutamide or not in the watchful waiting arm. I think it was a Scandinavian segment of the trial that there was increased death in the guys who got bicalutamide.
Yeah, but with bicalutamide therapy, they have elevated testosterone levels.
That's correct. But you got at before, is it the mechanism of action based on testosterone suppression? I gave you one theory in which it would be based on the endothelial cells around the coronary arteries, but it may not be. It may just simply be on the downstream effect of androgen blockade. We don't know. So I'm trying to put two and two together there. It's speculative at best at this point.
What would you speculate in terms of quality of life if it turns out that men, you know, with extremely high-risk situations or high-risk situations really require indefinite or longer-term therapy? What would you speculate the difference would be in quality of life if it turned out that bicalutamide and LHRH agonist had the same anti-prostate cancer effect?
The obvious things we know are there's the gynecomastia issue that you have with high-dose bicalutamide. You don't have as much with LHRH, but that can be prevented for the most part with low-dose radiation to the nipple areolar complex. We know that, as you just mentioned, testosterone levels do not disappear in men on bicalutamide, whereas they essentially do on LHRH. So you'd probably expect that on the bicalutamide monotherapy, people would probably have a better quality of life when you think about overall well-being, functioning, fatigue, etc.
What about the issue of selection of patients for endocrine therapy? Can you go through sort of how you approach it, if there are any new databases that have come out in the last couple of years that you think are important to consider, both in the localized situation and PSA relapse?
So in the localized situation, I think it's fairly clear that if you're going to treat a gentleman with radiation and they have a Gleason 8, 9, or 10, or a PSA certainly that's over 20, or if they have T2C, bilateral palpable disease, it's the classic high-risk patient, that hormonal therapy in conjunction with radiation is indicated. The randomized trials would support that. The gray zones are the Gleason 7s, particularly when they're low-volume Gleason 7s. People will argue that this is where accentuated local therapies, high-dose radiation, for example, may be best. My own personal opinion is that I think Gleason 7s also benefit from at least a short course of hormonal therapy, and whatever radiation you want to use, high-dose or otherwise, is your choice. There's also the issue of PSA velocity, which is a prognostic factor we now appreciate. Particularly if your PSA rises more than 2 points in the year before diagnosis, there's a paper that was written in 2006 that suggested on retrospective look that, in fact, despite that rapid rise in PSA, you could impact cancer death in a favorable way. That is, you'd lower it if you gave that gentleman hormonal therapy in addition to radiation, even if he had no other high-risk factors. That factor alone was enough to confer a high risk of death, and the hormonal therapy was enough to reverse some of that. So I think in the locally advanced setting, there's no question. When you get to PSA relapse, there was a randomized trial done by the RTOG, 9601, in which they randomized men to radiation with or without 2 years of hormonal therapy. It happened to be 150 of Casodex. And that was completed in 2001, over 1,000 men. And these were men who were all rising PSAs after surgery. That study will answer the question of whether the addition of hormonal therapy to salvage radiation imparts a benefit or not. For now, though, without that study in place, or without any study in place, what I do and what many will do is we look at the kinetics of the PSA and how long it took the patient to fail and what their characteristics looked like at surgery. So specifically, if a man has a rapid rise in PSA characterized by a short doubling time.
Short being what?
Something under 6 months. Or a short interval to failure, something less than 3 years. Or a Gleason score of 8 to 10 or seminal vesicle invasion at the time of prostatectomy, and then he fails with a PSA failure, then these men are the ones in which I personally would add hormonal therapy to the course of radiation. I tend to use short course in these cases, and that's because I'm extrapolating from the data in the de novo setting. But you could make an argument for long course, particularly in the Gleason 8 to 10s, if the man is younger and likely to rebound his testosterone quickly. Now, if you have somebody with a long doubling time, more than 12 months, somebody whose interval to failure is long, more than 3 years, someone with prostatectomy who had Gleason 7 or less, and maybe had a positive margin but no other evidence of extraprostatic disease, that's a gentleman where you might consider radiation alone at the time of PSA failure. Then there's a middle group. You know, what about the guys whose doubling times are between 6 and 12 months? What about the guys who have a Gleason 7, a 4 plus 3, but they've also got extracapsular extension, a positive margin, an invasion of the base of the seminal vesicle? Let's take that case. What do you do with them? I err on the side of being cautious there, and I tend to give them both the radiation and the hormonal therapy. I treat them as if they're the poor performers, even though that might be over-treatment in some of them. So I think right now the rising PSA setting is a setting where we have absolutely no randomized data to help us yet. We hopefully will by the next time you and I speak, because the RTOG has completed that trial. But for right now, we base it on those prognostic factors, doubling time, interval to PSA failure, and Gleason score.
What fraction of patients who present at first diagnosis now represent the clear high risk and question mark intermediate?
We have registries that are now updated through the end of 2006. And what's clear is that the number of men who present with high-risk disease has been declining to where in 2006, it's about 20% of all men present with high-risk disease in the United States. It's still much higher in Europe, where PSA is not used as often. The major determinant of high risk in this country is not PSA, not clinical stage, but it is Gleason score. So we still see somewhere in the 15 to 20% range of Gleason 8 to 10s.
What fraction intermediate?
You have about 30% intermediate and about 50% true low risk. So we've moved the table into the earlier dimension because of PSA.
And similarly, of all men in a year, for example, who present with PSA progression, what fraction fall into the category that you think require treatment?
So about a third of men who get treated with local therapy will experience a PSA relapse at some point during their life. Then of those men, only about 10 or 15% will fall in the very, very favorable category of a local-only failure. And a similar number, about 10 to 15%, will be in the worst category of doubling times less than 3 months, you know, the ones where we think they're almost always metastatic, leaving somewhere between 70 and 80% of the PSA failures in the middle, where they probably have components of local and distant failure. And so there's a huge dearth of knowledge that we're missing for that middle group. And what I do currently is I treat them with combined therapy, as I mentioned, but what's best there is not clear.
Now, in your trial looking at 6 months of therapy, you used maximal androgen blockade. Is that what you do off protocol now, and what's the rationale?
On the studies that have been designed looking at Taxotere, if it's short course hormonal therapy, they use combined hormonal blockade, and that is what I do for short course being 6 months or less. For long course hormonal therapy, based on the RTOG databases, for the first 4 months they'll use combined, and for the next 2 years they'll use monotherapy, as the Europeans did in their 3-year study. So you ask the rationale. There is no rationale, in my mind, for using combined. It's simply the way the studies were done. We don't know whether combined is better than monotherapies, especially in the short course setting. I justify the combined therapy if it's short course because the added toxicity, if you will, from the combined over the monotherapies is not that much more for a short course setting, but you certainly wouldn't want to do it over the long term. There really isn't a good answer as to what the rationale is. You can go back to the metastatic trials of Crawford and Eisenberger and try to justify that combined helps a more favorable subset of men with metastatic disease, but that couldn't be validated. So at this juncture, it's combined with short course based on the way studies were run, not necessarily based on pre-existing logic.
What else are you up to?
The other thing, this is more for screening, but there's a paper that Klaus Roburn and I published a few months ago in The Lancet Oncology. It was a randomized trial done 7 years ago now, looking at men taking Propecia, men in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. Propecia is a medicine you take for hair loss. It's a pill. And it turns out that it lowers PSA in exactly the same way Proscar does, cuts it in half within a year. And the reason why I think that's important is because men in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who are starting to have their screening as they get into their 40s will have falsely lowered PSAs. And if the primary care doctors are not aware of it, they may actually hide a prostate cancer long enough that by the time it presents, it could be more advanced.
So what was the paper looking at?
It was a randomized trial in which men were randomized either to Propecia for a year or placebo. And PSAs were taken every 12 weeks and compared. And what you saw at the end of the study was that in the men who were on the Propecia, the PSA dropped by about 50% in a year, whereas on placebo, it remained relatively unchanged. The thing that was surprising to me is that when I talked to primary care doctors at a recent internal medicine update meeting I was at, it had not crossed their radar screen that Propecia could impact PSA in this way, even though when, I think it was Merck, put out the package insert, they said that even though it hasn't been studied or proven up until now, that it has the potential to drop PSA because at a higher dose at 5 milligrams, it could. That did not hit the primary care doctor's attention until recently. So I think it's important because it has implications on how we interpret PSAs in young men on this drug for screening purposes.
Let's maybe talk a little bit about what's new in radiation oncology as it relates to prostate cancer treatment. Anything that's come out in terms of research finding or technical advances that you want to comment on?
There is one interesting finding that also will be at this meeting in Florida in a couple of weeks, and that is that there's a randomized trial in which men were randomized to lower high-dose radiation, 64 versus 74 gray, and 64 is actually called substandard radiation these days. But the difference was that all of these men had a short course of hormonal therapy in addition, and there was still a PSA benefit seen in the higher-dose arm. There has been question for a while as to whether or not if you added hormonal therapy to higher dose radiation, would you still see the benefit of the higher dose? And the answer appears to be yes. You still see a benefit to higher doses of radiation, even in the setting of hormonal therapy, which adds some credence to dose-escalated radiation and hormonal therapy in men with higher risk disease, as opposed to standard dose radiation and hormonal therapy. People ask the question, if you're treating a guy with high-risk disease and you're giving him hormonal therapy, what dose of radiation do you deliver? And so there's two databases you can draw from. One is the MD Anderson study, and the other one is the Proton study. One used 79.2, and one used 75.6. That's the MD Anderson study, even though it's written as 78. When you normalize and do things the way we do them today, it would be 75.6. So I tell people, something between 75.6 and 79.2 is reasonable, but of course, from a radiation oncology perspective, now you have to protect the rectum because the rectum tolerance stops at around 70 gray. And so there are techniques that you can use, either be an intrarectal balloon or some kind of localization device and daily setup to protect the rectum if you're going to go to higher doses.
Anything else that they ask you that you might want to comment on?
People have asked about Taxotere because now we know that it works in the metastatic setting, and you know, I refer them to the trials that are being done. I'm actually the principal investigator on the radiation 6 months of hormones plus or minus Taxotere study. And you know, I think people are asking, I have a young man, he's 40-something years old, he's got Gleason 9 disease, I don't think radiation hormones are going to be enough, would you add Taxotere? And the answer is really not off of a study because we don't know yet what it's likely to do. We know it can have some toxicity, although it seems to have been pretty well tolerated. No chemotherapeutic drug is without toxicity. So they do ask about that. My answer right now is no, I wouldn't use it off study. Pending the results, maybe we'll be in a new paradigm one day.
Could I pick up a little bit about this issue of tolerability? The taxanes are very commonly used in breast cancer as kind of part of daily life. How do you see it playing out in men with prostate cancer in terms of quality of life? What's the experience like for them? How long does it take them to recover?
Some of it's dosing. So we're using 60 milligrams per meter squared, which is a full dose for 3 cycles during the neoadjuvant 2 months of hormonal therapy. And then we use weekly Taxotere at 20 milligrams per meter squared for the 8 weeks of radiation. And, you know, I must say that, you know, we've treated 50 people this way so far, and we haven't seen any hospital admissions, haven't seen any increase. I thought we'd have a lot of increase in diarrhea, especially since we're treating the pelvis. The increase in diarrhea has been minimal. Most of what people note is there are changes in blood counts that mean that we have to watch, you know, the platelets and the hemoglobin. But no one, again, has been transfused for such drops in counts. There have been some issues with neuropathies, tingling in the fingers and the toes, changes in taste. And most of these have, not all of these, have been transient and resolve after the treatment is complete.
Now, they don't get treatment after the radiation?
No. So this is a neoadjuvant and concurrent study. So they get the Taxotere during the 2 months of neoadjuvant hormonal therapy and then concurrently with radiation.
What about overall sort of quality of life with these men in terms of nausea or fatigue or just how they feel?
There's no nausea or vomiting with the Taxotere, at least not the way it's been given. Fatigue, yes. And it's hard to discern whether that fatigue is Taxotere and the hormonal therapy or the hormonal therapy. The chemotherapy, though, is pretty much out of their system within a couple of weeks, probably within a week after the last dose is given. So the fatigue we see that lingers, we attribute to hormonal therapy. But this is being prospectively assessed, so we'll have information down the road. I can tell you, though, that, you know, I have men in their 70s undergoing this, and hard to tell the difference between who's getting radiation and hormones versus who's getting all three. Remember that in the study from the metastatic setting, these men were very sick, all had metastatic prostate cancer, and there were no toxic deaths from the Taxotere in those studies.
What about the issue of the patient who has hormone-resistant disease and yet it's still PSA only? Is that a situation, you know, in a younger patient or very rapid doubling time, et cetera, that you think that the use of docetaxel or Taxotere might be a consideration off study?
I've seen medical oncologists do this. There actually is a study being mounted to answer that specific question, but Dr. Petrolak is one that comments on this often. They'll take the whole clinical situation into account, and I think off study it does happen, but I think that once a study's in place, they'll want to study it properly and assess whether it benefits there or not. I also will say that Taxotere is probably the first of many things to come. It's just the first agent that we've found to be effective. There are many, many more being studied. There are all kinds of drugs being combined with Taxotere now to see if there's an additive or synergistic benefit. And then there's the whole issue and story emerging around vaccines, which also appear to be very exciting. And they're being compared in randomized studies head-to-head with Taxotere.
I'd kind of like to take a step back and kind of talk about some global issues in prostate cancer research, and mentioning these patterns of care studies that we've been doing, real simple things, just random surveys of docs. And, you know, you continue to see an incredible disparity in how radiation oncologists in practice and urologists in practice say they manage prostate cancer. It's amazing. You present the same exact case to them and you see very different answers. Any thoughts about where that's heading?
I'd be interested to see the cross-section of people that are studied in that. I think that if you get people who are closer to training, because I think that in the last 5 years, for sure, maybe as long as 10, people are trained more uniformly in terms of their approach to the disease than they were 15 or 20 years ago, because 15 or 20 years ago, the thought process was the only selection for surgery versus radiation was your age, either over 70 or under 70. There wasn't much else. PSA and Gleason and risk groups have all come into play since then. But I think the more recent graduates are more on the same page. But having said that, there will always remain some questions about how to best manage. Let's take a low-risk patient who's 63-year-old with low-risk disease. Since we have no evidence in that setting to say that surgery versus radiation versus watchful waiting in a low-risk patient, there's no evidence to say that any of these are better or worse, there will continue to be disagreement and people will continue to do what they think is best, not because we have a study that says it, but because there is no studies that have examined it. But I think in the higher risk patients, more recent graduates would agree that combined modality therapy of some sort is needed. People may still go for surgery with a Gleason 9, all the cores, and, you know, PSA of 20, but I think now the younger surgeons are saying, well, I'll take your prostate out, and then you're going to need to have radiation and hormones to follow. Now, whether that's right or wrong, you know, there's no way to know at this point. I think the radiation oncologist would see that patient and say, I'm going to give you radiation and hormones. So, yes, there is no consensus there, but there is a consensus that more than monotherapy is needed in such men. So I think that's where we've moved to. I think there's still disagreement on low risk, consensus on high risk that it requires multimodality therapy, but what those therapies are and when surgery is used or not used still differs.
What are your thoughts about doing surgery in that situation you just described?
Well, you know, I've never been against surgery in such settings with the thought in mind, though, that we have effective systemic therapy. And that's the real thing for me. I think that as we move towards discovering systemic therapies that are effective, one of two things will happen. Either surgery will become used more because now we're going to say, well, even though it's a big bulky lesion, we can take it out surgically, use radiation for the postoperative bed, and then we've got these effective systemic therapies that will take care of the micrometastatic disease, essentially what we do in locally advanced breast cancer. Or what might happen is if these systemic therapies are so effective, like they are in testicular cancer, they may obviate the need for any local therapies at all, and maybe you would then defer to radiation because it's less toxic. I don't know where we're going to head with this. It depends on how effective the systemic therapies are proven to be down the road. I don't know if Taxotere will be able to jump over that hurdle or not, but the studies we're doing will tell us.
I guess the related global question is, what about clinical research in prostate cancer? Is that going to be able to be sort of ratcheted up a little bit of a notch? I mean, when you look at where things are with prostate versus breast, even colon, even lung cancer, in terms of the data that's available, it's a little discouraging.
Well, some of the big studies that are going to be reported soon are the screening studies, you know, the big PSA screening studies in Europe and the United States. And so there, we'll catch up and hopefully have an answer that will provide hope for men with regard to serum markers. With regard to serum markers other than PSA, there's a whole host of research that's occurring. And here is where the people have moved into genomic-based assays to try to see if there's a better way to describe the aggressiveness, the biology of prostate cancer. There's been no home run yet. But there have been some interesting findings that are providing clues to where we may be heading. With regard to treatment, something that's getting favor right now, and I don't know if it'll last or not, is focal therapies for men with small volume, low risk disease. Can you just focally ablate the cancer, follow the gentleman when he develops another lesion, focally ablate it again? People have looked at HIFU, cryo, radioactive seeds, cyberknife radiation is another form of radiation that you can do this with. And these are just sort of in their infancy, but they're gaining popularity as we diagnose smaller and smaller cancers in older and older men. And I think that's where most of this is occurring. I think that the way in which that will move forward or not is based on imaging. And what I mean by that is if we have imaging that we can say is reliable to follow a gentleman and say, okay, well, there's the next lesion. We need to like blow out a kidney stone. We need to blow out that little lesion in your prostate. Then this could take some form. But I'm not convinced yet that we have the imaging modality that can do that. And I guess the final area of interest is really getting more towards patient-focused therapy and assessment of complications. You know, I can't stress this more. Let's just take an example of salvage brachytherapy for men who have had prior radiation and are thought, based on their presentation, to have failed locally only. You know, there are a few studies now emerging looking at salvage brachytherapy after primary radiation, and you're seeing these control rates of 50, 60% out at 5 years. But I think what's so important in that setting, where the toxicities can be quite substantial with regard to colostomy, prostatitis, and urostomies, that patients' opinions of, was it worth it with my quality of life as it is right now? Am I satisfied? And also just careful scoring of these complications as we move ahead is very important. I think when we move into treatments that have the potential for increased toxicities, that it's not just the physician's assessment, but the patient's vote that matters in that setting, because they'll tell us whether or not this potentially life-saving maneuver we've done was worth it or not.
You know, you described a bunch of things with opportunities, but getting back to those 20% of men with high-risk disease and another third with intermediate disease, and I assume this is where the prostate cancer mortality is coming from, it just seems that we're so far behind the other tumors. I'm trying to figure out how we're ever going to catch up.
Well, I mean, it's all these systemic therapy trials that are being done now. Right now in prostate cancer, so there's 9 randomized trials looking at all these different systemic agents in conjunction with Taxotere being compared to that. Anything that comes from that will then be pushed back into the intermediate and high-risk group that you just mentioned, just like we have taxotere being studied there right now. I think we are moving ahead. I've been doing this for a little over a decade, and when I came into the field, it was only local therapy, and endocrine therapy was used for end of life. We have certainly moved beyond that, but you're right. With regard to what's gone on in colorectal and breast and even lung, we still have a lot to go. So there is a lot more to do and a lot more to learn. The good news is that the death rate from prostate cancer, when you look across the board, is declining. Why? It's unclear. The number of men who die of prostate cancer each year is in the 29,000 to 30,000 range in this country, down about 10,000 from where it was a decade ago. So something's being done right. But yes, when that death rate's under 1,000, then we have something to really be grateful for. I'd love to see this turn into testicular cancer, but for that, we're going to need a real systemic agent that has unbelievable efficacy, and I don't know that there's anything out there just yet, but people are looking.